precious metals rally continued this week, with silver adding nearly a dollar on tight supply conditions. Welcome, everyone. Chris Waltzek back with you. We've got another Muy Grande size show. Well, it was a big week for the precious metals investors. The smart money poured into bullion. The outlook remains robust, according to my first guest, who's calling for $5,000 to $10,000 gold in the coming years. Dr. Stephen Lee, best-selling author, head of The Complete Investor, says ultimately gold is the only reliable money and every investment account must have some exposure, but silver could outperform gold, as we saw this week, climbing well into the triple digits. Crude oil probably found a bottom, although it may correct here in the next few weeks. We may never see sub-$30 crude again. Next up, investing superstar Robert Kiyosaki, Rich Dad, says he doesn't care if gold flies higher. He just added $1 million worth of the stuff to his big stockpile. He penned two books with presidential candidate Donald Trump, Why We Want You to Be Rich and The Midas Touch. He points out that every investor has to own gold because, frankly, zero or near zero interest rates makes investing for interest a non sequitur. And Robert Ian wraps up the show with another big report. GoldSeek.com radio begins now. Visibility virtually unlimited over the precious metals sector this week for the second week running amid increased threats of EU exits by Greece and Britain, and much lower odds of a U.S. rate hike. The yellow metal surged to $12.75, picking up about $30, 2.5% for the week. Silver added almost a dollar, 5.5%, closing at $17.33 an ounce, while the precious metal shares, as seen in the XAU index, added about 1.5%, 1.33 points, finishing at 90.4. They remain over 100% higher for the year, and West Texas Intermediate crude added about 17 cents, closing above the $49 per barrel point, but the technical condition suggests we could see a wave of selling as soon as next week. The top story driving the precious metals into the stratosphere, the non-threat of higher rates. A newly dovish Fed has shown no intentions of increasing for perhaps the rest of the year. Lower rates boost demand for precious metals as interest-bearing shares and debt lose relative competitiveness. The near certainty of a rate hike in July has collapsed now, according to the latest Fed futures funds odds readings on Friday. The story gets even more compelling against the backdrop of negative rates throughout Europe, and news from EU economic ministers that more QE measures are likely. This announced on Thursday. The inflationary report is a gold positive, but also dollar positive. And the fact that gold and silver advanced against a strong greenback, yet another good sign. But the top story was silver, which, according to Bloomberg reports, blasted higher on tight supply conditions. Output from silver mines reportedly declined for the first time since 2011 amid record industrial demand, which has climbed for 4 years consecutively. That according to a CPM Group report. Silver ETF holdings are approaching an all-time record high of up 25% in 2016, worth about $11 billion. That's a good pile of silver. And just with an earshot of the 2014 all-time record. And a major junior silver small cap miners ETF has nearly climbed 300% in 2016, recording a remarkable advance. Traders have added about $9 billion also to the Spider Gold Shares ETF this week, making the ETF the most sought after and highly funded of all the hundreds of competing ETFs, that according to Bloomberg. Meanwhile, the smart money continues to pour into the sector, with Stanley Druckenmiller and George Soros, have, as we've discussed for weeks here on the show, adding to their stockpiles. Soros noted in a televised interview this week that the odds of a Grexit is now 50-50, and we could see a national bankruptcy, which of course increases the demand for the safe haven of gold and silver. And of course, I'm sure many listeners know or are aware that the silver drachma was considered one of the world's most sought-after currencies for almost 700 years due to the fact that they kept their drachma backed by silver and silver coinage. Well, as soon as that was removed, the rest is history. Precious metals, bottom line. Well, despite dollar strength, gold and silver are all showing uptrends in every time frame, from the 1 hour daily to the weekly charts. This is a very solid sign of support. I expect gold stocks to consolidate now as the underlying metals play catch-up with silver, retesting major resistance and overcoming the 1850 point perhaps in the coming weeks. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, cloudy skies appeared over the New York Stock Exchange this week as lowered rate hike odds put downward pressure on financial shares. The Dow Jones Industrials have picked up 58 points over a third of a percent, finishing at 17,865 for the week, while the S&P 500 finished off 3 points fractionally, closing near the break-even point at 2,060-2,096, and the NASDAQ was off about 1%, down 48, recoiling from a recent high down to 48.94. Well, not only did the threat of a Grexit worry markets, but this week an Engxit, where voters will vote in Britain whether or not to remain in the EU. Concerns about the referendum and the UK's membership could threaten the stability and viability of the European Union. In addition, the FOMC meeting is slated for next week, but due to the worst employment report in nearly 6 years, officials will almost certainly hold rates and maybe even until next year, according to the latest Fed Funds futures rate contract. Lower rates continues to weigh heavily on our financial sector, which has been a key component of the multi-year bull rally. Well, bottom line on Wall Street. Although market volatility is viewed by the CBOT VIX is tame and fear and greed remains elevated, I continue to look for buying opportunities in the coming months. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with our two big guests and Robert Ian. We'd like for you to stay with us right here. My featured guest today, Dr. Stephen Leeb, has over a quarter century of investment experience, author of several bestsellers, including The Oil Factor, The Coming Economic Collapse, and his latest Red Alert. Welcome back, Dr. Leeb.
Thank you so much, Chris. Always a pleasure to be with you.
It's great to have you back with us today. Start off with the crude oil market. What an explosive rally. From under $30 a barrel, knocking on the door at 50, kept hearing calls of, you know, sub 20, $15 to $20 per barrel crude. And of course, it just wasn't to be. And now we're hearing the naysayers talk about this huge oil glut, but they seem to be ignoring tensions in the Mideast with Turkish forces now entering Syria. Is there something going on here that maybe the mainstream is missing?
Yeah, I mean, Chris, there's definitely something going on that the mainstream is missing, and it's not just in the oil market. But just speaking about the oil market per se, the dramatic fall in oil prices, I mean, there's no doubt they crashed and burned. They were trading at $100 or so between 2011 and, you know, up through 2014. What happened in 2014 is virtually every major oil producer started producing full throttle. It was probably the first time since the Industrial Revolution, every major producer of the most important energy source, and oil still is our most important energy source, was producing at a level that basically translated into a loss for them, a level at which they could not fulfill their budgetary needs. Saudi Arabia started borrowing money like crazy. We're going through the reserves. Ditto for, you know, virtually every other country, from Russia to Kuwait, etc. And, of course, even the U.S. with their frackers could not afford to produce what they were producing. They were producing at a loss. We have never seen a situation like that. Maximum production to, you know, in the context of everybody basically losing money. So it was an extraordinary event. Now, if you take a step back, what you find is that despite the temporary glut that was created during that period, and it took like this total geopolitical anomaly. I mean, anomaly is not a strong enough word to create this kind of glut. Despite this glut, the market is coming around and is starting to balance. That's frightening. Not frightening because you expect oil prices to go dramatically lower again, but frightening because if it takes full throttle production by virtually everyone to keep oil prices to keep oil low, and it still starts to balance, what's going to happen when, you know, demand continues to pick up? It's going to be a very, very, it could be a very, very dramatic scene. There's so much that I just think people are overlooking with the oil market. The fracking, I think it's a consensus view. The reason the Saudis led this sort of surge in oil production was to gain market share. gain market share from the frackers? I thought this was a long-term game. Fracking is not going to be around for, you know, much more than 5 years at most. At most. Basically, they shouldn't try and destroy another oil producer when any analysis of the situation tells you oil is going to become scarce. You don't want to destroy somebody that can, you know, basically interfere with that scarcity and, you know, be able to produce more oil and sort of keep the oil train rolling for maybe another 4 or 5 or 6 years. It's never made sense to me that the sole reason for this phenomenal or almost out of a fantasy land type of action by these oil producers, it never made sense to me that it was solely designed to destroy the frackers. It's basically in the long-term interest of the Saudis and other oil producers to have other producers around. They're no threat to the Saudis. Who are they going to gain market share from? I mean, you know what? Saudis are going to, you know, gain market share from Canada? I mean, you know, the frackers are using all their oil here. Basically, what I've seen. I just look at the basic numbers that are coming out. And one number, one of the many numbers that just sort of like glares at me and is blinding, has been the dramatic increase in imports of China's a basket case. They're falling off the cliff. And they have this problem and that problem. But, you know, one problem they don't have is need for oil, evidently. I mean, you know, despite all these problems about their, you know, economy, et cetera, which I think are, you know, really just ridiculous. But anyway, oil imports from China have been surging. And in fact, today, I mean, the year-over-year change in oil imports from China right now is about what it was when China was growing at double-digit rates. That's incredible to me. And that's not like an outlier, because you can say the same thing about copper, almost the same thing about silver, and the last I looked at, you can say almost the same thing about iron ore. But let's just focus on Chinese oil imports. I think this is part of the game. It's not the fracking. People are just obsessed with the fracking. I mean, in this country, I mean, fracking is, yeah, it's something. It's on a, you know, any sort of long-term scale, it's a blip. What's not a blip is what is happening in the eastern part of this world. China is very slowly seizing control. And one of the things China wanted to do last year was to start trading in a new oil benchmark. But that was deferred, probably because of what was going on in the oil market. But their plans have not been deferred. I mean, for China, a year here or there doesn't mean so much. They have their eye set on the prize, the longer-term prize. And that longer-term prize is a benchmark for the eastern part of the world. And to me, and here I'm speculating, okay, I mean, the numbers I gave you about Chinese imports, et cetera, the numbers I gave you about, you know, every oil producer producing at levels that don't balance their budgets, that's never happened before, all that is true. And it's also true that China plans to start their own oil benchmark, which no doubt will be traded in yuan and be the benchmark for a good part of the eastern half of the world. That benchmark is scheduled to start this year. Now, why then, if you look at it from that perspective, it becomes a little bit more rational what the Saudis seem to be doing. They seem to be vying to have their oil be increasingly large part, as large a part as possible of that new benchmark. Because consider, when you're trading a benchmark in oil, that benchmark is not, you know, just oil. I mean, there's heavy oil, there's light oil. I don't know all the different kinds of gravity, et cetera, et cetera. The Saudis produce a certain kind of oil. The Iranians produce a certain kind of oil. The Russians produce a certain kind of oil. Basically, you're in the more of your oil that is part of that benchmark, the better off you are. And that is what I think is happening to the oil market. And I think oil prices are, you know, basically going to go, either one of two things happen. Oil prices go dramatically higher because they are scarce. Oil is relatively scarce. If full throttle production held demand, or, you know, basically overwhelmed demand for a year or two, and that was it? I mean, what happens now? But any oil goes a lot higher is what happens now. Basically, the Chinese are seizing control of the oil market. Where's oil demand going to come from? It's going to come from the eastern part of the world. And it's not clear to me, and this is what's so frightening, is there even enough oil left in order to effect a transition from hydrocarbon world to a renewable world, at least in part? I mean, that to me is the real open question. Look, I have to credit E.F. Schumacher. Really, I think one of the great unsung intellectuals of the 20th century, certainly very important in Britain winning the, or in Britain's war effort during World War II. But he wrote this book, which I'm sure certain people hate, but nevertheless, it has a lot of very good points. It's called Small is Beautiful, Economics as If People Matter. You know, despite the gushy title, it has a lot of wisdom. And one piece of wisdom that I picked up on was the fact that, you know, stop with the macro projections, okay? They're probably not worth the paper they're written on. Instead of making these grand macro projections, et cetera, just look at the facts and look at what you're dealing with. Plan out what the implications could be. Not necessarily how we're going to get there, but, you know, can we get to a particular place? And these are just basic facts. 17% of the world's population controls about 80% or so of the world's material wealth. That's absolutely incredible. It means that if the rest of the world grows fourfold, they will be basically up to where the developed world is. I mean, it's a developed world. 17% of the population that controls about 80% or 80, yeah, something like 80% of the wealth of the world, 80% of the material good, 80% of the income. There is not a prayer that we have enough goods around so that the developing world, of which China is leading the way, could come close to where we are in the richer part of the world. For instance, you need four times as much oil per day. Can you imagine a world in which the call on oil is 320 million barrels a day? No. Silver production has to quadruple? No. You can't. This world's in a lot of trouble. Oil is definitely leading the way, Chris. I'm sorry to give you such a long-winded answer on it. This whole business about oil going down to 20 and 30, I mean, this is like, I don't know what we're staring at, what we're looking at. I mean, you know, Schumacher was making points that refuted this, you know, 30, 40 years ago. And it's obvious. It's really obvious. With China sitting there as a catalyst for growth in the East, in the undeveloped part of the world, you have nowhere to go for any of these commodities but up. And oil is right now probably the scarcest and most essential of these commodities. It's Schumacher. Most of what I'm saying is just acting as a reporter and just translating, you know, facts that are right in front of us. And my beef is with the complacency and the nearsightedness of this country, basically is it, because this is stuff that's in front of all of us. This should not be controversial. Anything I'm saying should not in any way be controversial. It's back of the envelope calculations. You need a four function calculator. You can do it all by hand if you want to, but you know, no more than four functions. Yes, no, this people have to wake up. That's what I mean. I'm angry. I'm upset.
I can see why, you know, the emotions are running high. You know, maybe we have the luxury for the subjects that you've brought to the fore here. The typical everyday domestic American is struggling just to pay the bills. I mean, look, this is from the Federal Reserve. Less than half of Americans can even put $400 together if there's an emergency. So addicted to credit, debt, and of course, credit cards, and all the related lines of credit and mortgages and second mortgages and the list goes on, fallen into a downward vortex.
Quagmire, downward vortex, great words, really great descriptions, yes.
And unfortunately, I think in such a scenario, people just can't look forward. We're struggling day to day to make ends meet. And I guess that's maybe a subject for a totally different show. Let's talk about silver.
I mean, I don't even know where to start when I see these, when you... I mean, it's happening before our eyes. And, you know, and it's, yes, people are struggling. It's a terrible, terrible thing to see. but it basically is an issue of policymakers. We are so complacent and so in denial in this country. It sometimes boggles the mind. I mean, how many in this country think China doesn't have a big problem? Everybody thinks they have a big problem. I mean, I have a friend who comes over on Wednesday. He's an exceptionally bright guy. Do chess together. He's Russian, et cetera. I mean, he teaches me. I'm not anything to brag about. But I say, you know, to him, Michael, let's just punch up the headlines on Bloomberg and find out how many of these headlines say bad things about China. It's usually about 20 or 25%. Now, did you read any news story yesterday that said that China, which is true, that wages in China last year, 2015, when the economy was on the verge of just breaking apart, wages in China grew 10% last year? That's a remarkable number. Double-digit growth in wages. And it can go on and on. And all this, you know, imported oil, imported copper, they are leading the way. And we are in total denial about it. And we cannot afford to let this happen. They're stockpiling everything. Also, silver imports have been rising very, very sharply for China. Let me just say this about silver, because I know you mentioned it, and then I'll shut up. I was embarrassed to be surprised by it, because I should know this stuff. I study it. But I was reading a report the other day, and again, I try and stay with the most credible reports. I try and, you know, look at information that basically seems trustworthy. So I'm reading something from GFMS, which is, you know, one of the leading experts on silver. They're a division of Thomson Reuters, major company, so-called objective reporting. And they just had a comment in there that silver production is peaking. I didn't know that. I mean, I knew that was close. I mean, you know, 10 years maybe or 5 years. I didn't know it was peaking now. Well, it's peaking right when solar production, solar energy is starting to really take off. I mean, you're talking about, you know, a major renewable energy supply taking off, and it's going to basically, over the next 5 years, and it's going to only continue to grow beyond that, but over the next 5 years, and again, I'm talking about estimates from Bloomberg Energy, estimates from the IEA, International Energy Agency, the amount of silver we're going to need for solar energy over the next 5 years will amount to more than a year's worth of silver production. We don't have it. We're going to have to draw down inventories. And then in the 1920s, I mean 1920s, in the 2020s, it's really going to start where we don't have the silver. I mean, that's just one example.
You bring up a great point. David Morgan, the silver investor, and I just discussed this yesterday on the show for nearly an hour. There's some really interesting aspects to the story and what you've brought up. I mean, firstly, as you say, and this is an exponential trend. Solar power, current trends, if we extrapolate forward and we do a regression analysis, we're actually forecasting shutdown of most of coal production because much of that is antiquated relative to the efficiency of these new solar panels. And as you pointed out, you know, there can be up to an ounce of silver depending on the wattage and whatnot. There is nothing that can really take the place. In other words, its demand is inelastic. Look at gold. Gold is 70 times more expensive. It's much more cost efficient, but you can't then step down in the other direction to copper because it's just too inefficient.
They won't last as long. I mean, silver is very durable, and silver is also the best electric conductor in the world. And the point is, I mean, the numbers that I've seen is right now, 2.8 million ounces of silver is equivalent to one gigawatt of solar power, which is nothing. And let's say that, you know, we get more efficient in using silver. So if it goes down to 2 million, it's a drop in the bucket. I mean, you know, given how much solar energy this world is going to need, I mean, in order to, you know, have any chance of avoiding the consequences of these scarcities, let's say in oil and other, you know, energy commodities, I mean, you're going to need all the renewables you can possibly get. It's not a question of climate change or anything. I mean, you can be agnostic about climate change. For all I care, you can believe the climate is getting colder, not warmer. But you're running out of oil. So what difference does climate change make? If you've got no energy, you don't have to worry about it to begin with, because you're going to have to segue into some other kind of energy. And solar and wind are, and water, hydro, are the three most likely. And when it comes to silver, Chris, I think it's 1% of our energy needs now. I mean, what you're dealing with, I haven't worked out all the numbers. For this world to run or have any chance of becoming a world in which, let's say, the sun becomes the major driver of energy, not the product of the sun over tens of thousands of years, namely fossil fuels, but the sun as it hits the earth today, if that's going to be the new energy, you're going to have a massive amount of electricity. I mean, right now, electricity counts for maybe 18% of energy production. That's got to rise to at least 50, 60%. It's got to basically, electricity has to provide our transportation needs, electric cars, et cetera. Everywhere you look in this chain, whether it be silver, even steel, graphite, cobalt, lithium, everywhere you look, rare earths, everywhere you look in this chain, you see impending scarcities. I mean, when it comes to, renewable energies. And you know what else you're going to need in order to, translate everything into renewable energies? A lot of oil, major amounts of oil. Who's best prepared for this transition? It's China by far. Commodity like graphite. I think they're the only integrated producer of graphite, the entire supply chain. That's it. It's China. Cobalt they control through their mines in Africa, the mines that they control in Africa. It goes on and on and on, and it scares the daylights out of me.
There are nuclear reactors there in China. You talk about silver and oil and the rest, but they're going to have as many nuclear reactors as the United States. Well, that sounds like a uranium potential.
Absolutely. You cannot, Chris, you're absolutely right. I don't think you can come up with the only, ironically, everybody talks about iron ore. Iron ore is probably the only commodity out there where there's no impending shortage. Unfortunately, in this interconnected world, there is a shortage of iron ore because there's no way of moving this incredibly heavy stuff from places like Brazil and Australia to all other places in the world without massive amounts of oil. I mean, it just takes that amount of oil in order to transport iron ore to other places. And once it gets to that or those other places, iron ore doesn't do you much good. I mean, but steel does. In order to, make steel into, make iron ore into steel, guess what you need? Massive amounts of heat, massive amounts of energy. We have not thought this out. I mean, that's my worry, and it's a major worry. I mean, the world has to come to its senses. China has come to its senses. China gets it. I honestly think half the time they're following, toward the end of the first chapter in Art of War. There's a direct statement in there saying part of war is to deceive the other people, to deceive your enemy. And I honestly believe that much of what they do is deception. Let me just give you one fact. This is another thing that surprised me. When you think of China's infrastructure development and how they're trying to broaden it out to the rest of the eastern part of the world, is there a particular bank you think of that they're trying to, really push forward? It's probably, let me just say that for me, when I thought of infrastructure and China's role in, let's say, developing this so-called Silk Road, One Belt, One Road, connecting Eurasia together, et cetera, one thinks of, the president of China, the bank that he's put forward is the AIIB, Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, okay? That was the one that the U.S. urged Britain and Europe not to join, and, finally everybody did join, and it was a very big deal. And it was supposed to be the signature project for China in terms of developing this sort of a Silk Road, the road that Marco Polo followed, and linking all parts of the East together. Basically, that was it. AIIB, that was the name of the bank. Well, Yes, and they put that forward. But what no one has focused on is that there are two other Chinese infrastructure banks. The Chinese, I think, National Bank and the Export-Import Bank. The first one is the largest development bank in the world, larger than the World Bank. I mean, that to me is unbelievable. The bank's been around like maybe 20 years, and it's larger than the World Bank, whose, you know, charter and mission is to develop the world. It's larger than that bank, which has been around since Bretton Woods, over 70 years. The third largest infrastructure bank is the Exim Bank, the Export-Import China Bank. And together, if you add up all the banks that China has and has invested, their investments in infrastructure throughout most of the East, and I guess other parts of the world too, but typically in the East, amounts to $2 trillion. $2 trillion. No one knows this. No one, I mean, they know it. I mean, I read about it in the Financial Times, again, being a reporter, but no one says a thing about this. And these are not banks like these state-owned banks where everybody talks about the debt that these state-owned banks have. Meantime, these other banks, China-controlled banks, have lent $2 trillion in infrastructure development. That's how come they control these African mines in cobalt. That's how come they control a major copper mine in Afghanistan. These projects are paying off for them, but no one has a clue. In total, complete denial as to what is happening. If I read another article about all this debt in China and how the country is crumbling because of it, I think I'm going to throw out my computers. I think I just can't read it anymore. It's like the emperor has no clothes. It's really that bad. I mean, we refuse, for whatever reasons, to admit to the fact that we are so far behind the curve. Now, I'm not saying this because I think it's hopeless. I'm saying this because I think we need a wake-up call in the worst sort of way. And you know, maybe, you know, someone will pay attention.
You bring together so many great topics here, and I think maybe we can simplify, maybe develop an action plan, okay, to tackle some of these problems. And I think we have to get back to basic principles. Let's look at the China miracle. I mean, it really mirrors and parallels the early success in the United States. We lived frugally. We supported the entire family network. There was the family farm, straight out of a Steinbeck novel, right? I mean, you were looking at the Grapes of Wrath and coherent family structure. Everyone respected their elders. Wow. When was the last time that happened? Today, over half of America, I'm not casting any aspersions here. I'm not trying to be negative. As you say, I'm stating the numbers, and over half of American families, households, receive some type of government assistance every month. This is a truism. It's roughly 160 million families. That's a remarkable number. Yeah, and we know that now most of working able-bodied Americans simply can't find reliable work, and we're turning to the wrong folks by limiting our spending, limiting debt, trying to do with less. Maybe you need an 800 or 1,000 foot square foot house instead of a 2 or 3,000 square foot home. Maybe we need to focus further on education simply because the job market is so tight. Well, as we wrap up here, can you give our gold and silver aficionados some guidance here in 2016 and maybe beyond?
Buy. I honestly think at this point, I look less and less each day at, you know, I have a lot of indicators, et cetera. I think gold may be under a little pressure temporarily, even silver. But I think these metals are going so much higher, Chris. I don't say, for silver, it's a combination of it being not only a precious metal, but an industrial metal. And we talked about its industrial loss, the scarcity of silver as an industrial metal. It's going to go, you know, $100 silver is, I think, you know, unless there's a world war or something like that, that's in the cards. And as far as gold goes, this whole notion of scarcity, which we've been talking about, everything oil to silver to graphite becoming scarce, how are you going to, you know, ration scarcity? How are you going to ration who gets the graphite, who gets the oil? You're not going to ration it by printing money. money is just, you know, it's worthless, basically. In fact, money is no longer even paper. It's just zeros and ones in a computer. And those zeros and ones can be stolen. I mean, and it's likely the Chinese will be the ones that have been stealing them. I mean, you know, you read about these electronic transfers that have been intercepted. That's frightening. The only way, the only currency in today's world of growing scarcities, of our ability to crack into computers and really, you know, steal the zeros and ones, make them, you know, ours instead of yours, I mean, whatever, is to have a currency like gold. Currency that's been trusted for thousands of years. It's a much more rational way to run a monetary system in today's world. It's just a question of when, not whether. And I think that, you know, the advice I give everyone in that context is that for the sake of you and your family, I'm not going to tell you how much gold and silver you should own, but you've got to have some. And I will say this, the next book I'm writing, and I've just about finished the proposal, I mean, the proposal is about 20,000-25,000 words, is on gold, because I feel that strongly about it. I mean, you know, I'm at the point in my life where, you know, I'm trying to do things that help. I'm not trying to, you know, write a book that's going to be necessarily a bestseller or anything like that. But I really believe that if people have, for people to have a chance in the kind of unwieldy, turbulent transition that I see, they're going to have positions in gold and silver. It's that obvious to me. It's almost not even a question. And I think gold miners and silver miners are probably the best way to play it. Though some people would say, well, I want to own the physical gold. Okay, not going to quarrel with that, but you've got to have some, you've got to have a stake in precious metals. You really must. For not only your sake, but again, the sake of your children, the sake of your dog, the sake of your cat, just, you know, all that you call your family, all that you call your friends. I mean, gold and silver, I think, are, you know, going to be the assets of the next generation. And I think the bull market you'll see in these metals and, you know, the investments attached to them, the miners, et cetera, it's going to surpass any bull market that any of us have ever seen in our lifetimes. And what I fear is that so few people will participate in it.
And you don't feel that that'll take another 10, 15 years?
I don't have a time frame, but I think that gold's going to hit 10,000 and maybe higher. And some of these, well, we've already seen, you've already seen Barrick go from under 6 to, where is it now, 17. What's gold done? It's gone up, what, 10%? So you've already seen some of this bull market in front of us. This is just the last 6 months. Now imagine if gold goes to 5 or 10,000. You're going to see these stocks go, they could go up literally 50, 100-fold. Some of the juniors that have, you know, really good properties, when somebody realizes you need gold, they're not going to worry about spending, you know, $5 billion on infrastructure to get to some of these amazing properties like Nova Gold, I mean, Donlin, which they share with Barrick. I mean, you know, I could go on and on about this. Yes, I think that the bull market will be probably a 10 or 15-year affair, but I think it's already started. And that's the thing. I mean, you know, there's already been, I think, a doubling in some of these gold mining indices. A doubling in the last 6 months. They may correct a little bit here and there, but I'm saying you should own them. And, you know, if they correct, I think you should probably buy more. But I, you know, I'm not going to tell anybody how much they should have. I mean, that's just got to be a personal decision. But I want to urge everyone to have some position in precious metals.
And it sounds like crude oil, you know, as well. Energy looks pretty good and the shares are beaten down.
You're going to make a lot of money there, too. But, you know, the danger of with crude oil, ironically, it's hard to find producers that can increase production because it's already become scarce. Gold will never be scarce in the sense that we will need more of it. We may have to raise the price of it continually, you know, if it's a currency, but we're never going to need more of it. Silver will become scarce because of solar. But gold has this remarkable property of being sought after, and it's never going to become scarce because it's not really needed for industrial uses. Yes, you said before it's a conductor, it's a catalyst, etc. It does have industrial and chemical properties that are valuable, but for all those properties, we can find substitutes. So gold can just sit there. And the value, I think, of all the gold in the world is something like, I don't know, $6-7 trillion. That's peanuts. when you look at the, you know, the total world economy and the numbers of transactions that take place, there's room for just a massive, massive bull market. And I think you've already seen it start.
David Morgan pointed out there's only 3 Olympic-sized swimming pools worth of gold in the world, period.
Isn't that amazing? Yes. I mean, that's something that I knew, but I've learned it, you know, relatively recently about how little there is of gold in the world. Get yourself some of it before it becomes too high priced.
Yeah, but let's extrapolate forward and say, well, if that's the case, there's only 30 swimming pools worth of silver.
That's true, too. That's true, too. Look, I mean, I'm both. I mean, if I had to guess over the next 5 years, or let's say the next 5 to 7 years, I think silver will outperform gold. That would be my guess. I mean, even Warren Buffett says when he talks about the United States and capitalism, he said, well, after all, it's been around for 250 years. Well, China as a civilization that has spoken Mandarin, as a civilization that has followed basically Confucianism, this has been around 2,000 or 3,000 years. Taoism, right, exactly, yes. I mean, it's been around thousands of years. We're babies. Of course we should be able to learn. It doesn't mean that we have to accept everything they're doing, but we should pay attention to what they do. And one thing they do very well is they long-term thinking.
What I really think it is, and this is maybe an oversimplification, everyone knows that a wounded creature has a tendency to lash out. I see us as a wounded creature that's lashing out instead of an intelligent creature that's asking for help, looking for answers.
Extremely well put, to be very honest. I mean, I really do. Very, very well put. I think you're absolutely right. And I think we need the right leader to lead us in the right direction. I mean, so that we do see things for what they are and we do make improvements. I haven't given up on America by no means. We're going to need a little bit of luck and, you know, maybe a little divine intervention. I mean, I don't know. But yes, I think you're absolutely right. We're lashing out. We're not trying to sit back and learn and try and improve ourselves as much as we are lashing out. And that's, I think, very, very well put on your part, Chris. I really do.
Well, we need flexibility. We have such a rigidity in our thought processes. I think if we could be a bit more flexible, recognize that's a strength. That's not a weakness. You were talking about Sun Tzu's The Art of War. You know, I've read the tome many times, written on it a bit. It's very easy to read. But that doesn't mean that the wisdom, you will capture it during the first time we read it, because it is so applicable, I think, to so many areas of our lives. Take a look at China. I mean, we're underestimating them. For instance, the longest standing massive civilization in the history of the world, still thriving today, thousands of years later. Let's take a look at the Great Wall of China. We call it the Great Wall. Now, what a joke. It's not a wall. It's the largest structure ever built. It makes the pyramids look like pimples. It encompasses the whole northern area of the country. So what is it really? It's the Great Castle of China. We have our thought processes so backwards here, we can't see the genius. We want to belittle the genius because we can't understand it. And that's the genius, I think, of China. And it's just the cusp, maybe it's just the beginning of what we have to learn here. You could spend a lifetime, as I think you've already done, studying this great culture. All right, we've gone on way too long. Dr. Stephen Leeb, thanks so much today. You've covered all the bases. Can't wait to read your next tome on our favorite subject here, the yellow metal.
Yes, absolutely. Chris, it's always a pleasure. Have a wonderful day, weekend, etc. Really, great pleasure talking with you.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the 8th largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves, industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garnero, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank, and founding director. Their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond. Your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Well, in 1997, entrepreneur and financial wizard Robert Kiyosaki penned Rich Dad, Poor Dad, still the number one personal finance book of all time, according to Amazon.com. Welcome back, Robert Kiyosaki.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Great to have you back with us. And I wonder if you could tell us a bit about your colleague, Donald Trump, someone that you've known for quite some time, a serious front runner presidential candidate.
Right. For those that may not know, Donald and I wrote two books together. And one was called Why We Want You to Be Rich. And Why We Want You to Be Rich is because, as you know, the poor and middle class are in decline. And the other book was Midas Touch for those who want to be entrepreneurs. So that's why we got together. And as far as I'm running for president, you know, I'm pretty forthright. I was pretty shocked at what he's saying these days, you know, because in real life, one-on-one, he's a perfect gentleman. He's easy to work with. He's smart. He's quick. But when I see him attacking the Pope and Mexicans and Muslims, I go, why are you doing that? You know, so that's my, there's a two-sided coin to this. So I don't know why he's doing that, but in person, he's a great guy.
Well, let's talk about Greenspan's latest comments. You know, former Fed head of the Federal Reserve, of course, noting the hyperinflation in Venezuela, a loaf of bread now as much as $10, if you can find it. He's saying that martial law in Venezuela could come to the United States. What do you think?
That's a pretty bold statement, considering he's the guy that's creating all this stuff that's going on right now. I mean, for those who may not know, Greenspan was Fed chairman during the Reagan era, and, you know, there was Reaganomics and all this stuff. I guess he would know. And I would say that Greenspan is probably, you know, extremely responsible for this economic bubble, boom and bust economy we've been in. I don't know if you know this, but since 2000, between 2000 and 2010, we've had three major market crashes, 1,000 times bigger than the crash of 1929. We had first the dot-com, then we had the real estate crash, and then we had the banking crash. And, you know, the bailouts for these banks, like you look at the first bailout was TARP, $700 billion. If that $700 billion, we could have built the entire interstate highway system of the United States with money left over. That's how corrupt our banks are right now. So we're not that far off from Venezuela.
If you look at the numbers, I wrote in Wealth Building Strategies 2010, they could have taken those trillions of dollars. It was about $3 trillion, I think, in economic stimulus following the 2008 credit crisis and housing smackdown to pay off virtually every foreclosure of the 10 million plus foreclosures in the United States. And instead, they gave it to their crony buddies.
Absolutely. It's called kleptocracy. We're no longer a democracy. We're a kleptocracy. And that's what happens when our leaders steal from us. So I think sick to my stomach. You know, some people get sick to the stomach with Trump. I said, you guys don't really know what's going on. That's the problem.
And take a look at Greenspan calling this out. Isn't that like the fox warning people about, you know, how he's already raided the hen house? The damage is already done. Everybody's pointing fingers at everyone else. And, you know, you're someone who pulled yourself up by your bootstraps. This is an American success story. Think that's why your books, your work, your lectures resonates, isn't it, with the typical American?
let's go back to, you know, the thing with Chicken Little and all that stuff. And, you know, if you really study the poem or the tome of Chicken Little and his buddies get eaten by the fox, because the fox says, "Welcome to my lair, my den." And Greenspan is that fox. So that's what I kind of find interesting about this whole kleptocracy. You know, it's just disgusting what we're doing to our own people. We're killing our own people. I'm just glad I'm wise enough not to get caught in the, not to be led down the lair.
I don't think we can even blame Greenspan. To me, he reminds me of an unwitting pawn, a puppet of, you know, these globalist masters have been setting up the United States for a big fall for about 100 years. Any thoughts?
It's not popular, but I'd have to agree with you. That's my finding is the same as yours. I mean, the way I look at it is, you know, we have this thing called the American spirit, which gives us strength to be entrepreneurs. But before Bernie Sanders could take over, or people like Bernie Sanders or people that Bernie works for, is they had to bust that American spirit. And the way they could bust that spirit is by making us poor. So that's why Trump and I wrote Why We Want You to Be Rich, because the more dependent Americans become upon the government, the more communists we become. And, you know, that, well, you say you can't use communists and all this stuff. I said, that's what happens when the government takes over us and the economy. So I know it's not politically correct to say it's a conspiracy and all that stuff, but that's what's happening, and the American spirit is busted. You know, the Fed just found out in their survey of 15,000 families that 47% of middle-class families can't even raise $400.
If an emergency comes up, let's say a problem with the, you know, with an engine or something, or maybe even a medical bill, very few people without using their credit cards could muster $400 in cash. There's no savings. You know, if memory serves, you recommend forget this credit card stuff, build a safety net, nest egg in case of emergencies. And most folks got caught in a situation and they're trying to dig their way out.
Well, there's good debt and bad debt. You know what I mean? I'm a real financial education guy because I'm in debt probably $600 million, a little over half a billion. But debt makes me rich. Unfortunately, there's consumer debt, which makes people poor. And so there's good debt and bad debt. I think the thing that is really quite interesting are old ideas. For example, I was doing this talk in Phoenix the other day, and naturally my favorite participants are financial planners. And it's a love-hate relationship. They're good people. But this woman stands up, and she's a financial planner. She says, "I don't like what you're saying." I said, "Well, don't you like about it?" She said, "You know, you've been saying savers are losers." I said, "Right, I did say that." She goes, "Well, how can you say that? You know, what about the magic of compounding interest?" And I said, "Ma'am, interest rates are near zero today. So what is zero squared? It's still zero." And she goes, "What?" I mean, they're so programmed to recite the song and dance from the banking system, you know, the magic of, you know, the rule of 72 and invest for the long term in the stock market and save money. I'm going, are you kidding me? You know, in 1970, when I graduated from college, if I put $1 million in the bank, I didn't have $1 million, but if I did, I could save my way to retirement. You know, $1 million times 15% in 1970 was $150K interest payments. You could live in $150K in 1970. Today, I put $1 million in the bank and I pay a negative 5 basis points, which means I pay $500 to keep $1 million in the bank. So why would you save money when you can't save your money? You can't save your way to security anyway.
You were talking about the lady who was promoting compound interest, but what happens when you have negative interest rates? There's something like $800 billion in sovereign bonds right now in the European Union and in Japan under Shinzo Abe are now issued in negative rates.
I said, how can you talk about the magic of compounding interest when it's negative? And then she wanted to argue me. I'm not a math guy, so I said, okay, zero squared is what?
Still have zero. Talk about baby boomers. This is in some of your literature you've put on the web and elsewhere. You're concerned that this group of folks, which was sort of the backbone of the U.S. economy, now is struggling, and you're concerned that this could lead to a market crash in the next year or so because they've lost confidence in the stock markets, and they might lose confidence in the bond market. Are they going to sell their homes? Where does all that capital flow?
Well, that's the million-dollar or the trillion-dollar question. But the reason I talked about the baby boomers is we're the only generation that's ever had a 401k. And the 401k was not to make the baby boomer rich, it was made to make Wall Street rich. And if you don't think anything else, look at how many fees are sucked out of 401ks. The worst thing about it is 80% of them don't have enough money to retire on, and they start retiring this year, but they have to start withdrawing in 2016. So I wrote a book called Rich Dad's Prophecy, calling for the biggest stock market crash coming in 2016 for a number of reasons. One, there being terrorism, and you know ISIS now controls the world. And then we have the 401k problem, which is now coming to the surface. Plus, most state pensions are out of money. So that's the problem. And also the baby boom generation, who was the luckiest generation in history, are going to be Venezuela, the richest. You know, Venezuela has the largest oil resources in the world, but they're broke. And the baby boomers are going to be future Venezuelans.
Look at the millennials, 25 to 35, over 5 million living in their parents' basements. That's over 50%. They can't find meaningful work.
The problem with being underemployed is you become unemployable later in life. And so that's really the danger. They don't have the job and skill sets or mindset to enter a real vibrant economy. So we're toast from baby boomers and the millennials.
Right. And then, of course, you've also discussed the concern about an aging population that's less vibrant. You've seen Tokyo, Japan really struggling with that. Incredibly wealthy society. Highest saving rates in the world still, even compared to China. They have something like $4 trillion sitting in pensions. They have an aging population. And as a result, those demographics can crush the economy. And we're facing that here because those 25 to 35s, they're not going to buy homes. They don't feel confident. If you don't have a good, solid middle-class job and you don't see a future in that job, and very few do today, you're not going to take on a 30-year mortgage.
Which is good news for me because I buy apartment houses.
Sounds like good news, though, for commodities at some point, because people are going to try to quantify and have a safe haven, a life jacket, a preserver, you know, to protect their wealth when the bubbles burst. And don't we have bubbles today in the stock market and the bond market?
And in the currency markets, I know this is gold seek, and when I look at what's going to happen to gold, right now money is running out of China and the Middle East into the United States, which makes the U.S. dollar stronger. And when the U.S. dollar is stronger, that makes commodity prices as gold and silver go down. That's either good or bad, but if you live in a weak currency country, then gold and silver go up in price. So it's all relative, as Einstein would say. But right now, I'm watching the money running out of the Middle East and running out of China and coming to our biggest cities like San Francisco and New York and Chicago. And that's where you have real estate booms, but the rest of the country is hurting. So it's kind of an interesting time. So I'm, you know, my game was called cash flow. So I'm always watching the cash flowing around the world right now. It's quite interesting.
The money flows are pouring in because interest rates are negative or very low elsewhere, and they're pouring in from both the Pacific and over the Atlantic. But eventually, I think that's going to give Fed officials the confidence to pull the trigger on QE4. What might that mean for the markets?
Well, if they announce QE4, I'd jump back into the stock market, obviously. But, and I think the reason they're announcing or they're forecasting the rate hikes is to force people to buy homes now. You know, before the rate hike goes up, you know, that makes sense to me. Or, you know, get your money out of, you know, start spending long term where you can use debt. So I think that's why they're forecasting or broadcasting rate hikes. It's a ploy. That's all I see it as. And I agree with you. I think the U.S. is sick, very, very sick. You just look at the unfunded liabilities. I've seen them estimated from $100 trillion to $225 trillion, which includes Social Security and Medicare. Now, when I talk to my guys who are really good with numbers, they say, oh, don't worry about it because the millennials will pay for it. So I think tend to agree with Greenspan. I said, I think we're going Venezuela. You know, that's it's already starting in Puerto Rico. If you understand the gold and the dollar, the gold, dollar came off the gold standard in 71 and then went on the petrol standard, the petrodollar with oil, in 74. And so I watch what's happening with terrorism, because the terrorists, you know, they're not really after oil. They're really after to bust the dollar. They want the dollar to go weak. But, you know, in 74, what's his name, Nixon and Kissinger signed a deal with the King of Saudi Arabia that all oil had to be traded in dollars. And you notice that in 9/11, 14 out of the 18 guys driving that plane were from Saudi Arabia, not Iraq. So why'd they attack Iraq? Why'd they attack Saddam? Because Saddam announced in the year 2000 that he was going to stop selling oil in dollars and start selling in euros. So he had to be taken out. And then you had that guy Gaddafi who said the same thing, but he says, I'm going to sell it in dinars. So Gaddafi got taken out. So there's more to terrorism and money and gold and stuff like this than meets the eye. So that's why, you know, CIA stands for Capitalism's Invisible Army, and D.C., Washington, D.C. stands for the District of Corruption. I watch all that stuff. That's what I watch. I don't listen to the news. I watch Trump go up there, and I watch Hillary promise to save us all, and I see Bernie going after her. And it's better than watching Jerry Springer. That's how I hold it right now.
And as we wrap up, can you give our gold aficionados any words of wisdom? And do you think we've seen the bear market lows? Might we have to retest the lows?
It doesn't matter to me about gold because I don't buy gold as an investment. I buy it as money. So, you know, the last 2 months, I bought another $1 million worth of gold because I trust gold more than I trust my government. So some people say in God we trust, it's in gold I trust. And I like what Ron Paul once said. He says, 200 years, you know, when the Spanish galleons went down, he says, 200 years later, people are still diving for gold. If a ship goes down today full of dollars, nobody's going to dive for it.
Where do you park $1 million of gold? Not specifically, but just a general idea. Does that stay in the coffers at a bank or does it go to Panama? What do folks do today with that?
There are safe houses all over the world. Like Singapore is a great safe house. Switzerland has great safe houses. Panama has them. You just got to do it legally. And I spent a lot of money doing it legally. But I don't want my gold near anybody. So it's all legally transacted. It's moved. It's in hard. I don't like ETFs personally. So I just hold gold in what I call private vaults.
So you and Mrs. Kiyosaki could get on the amazing yacht that you've told us about in the past, sail off to Singapore, and you'd have plenty of resources waiting for you.
Correct.
Robert Kiyosaki, it's always a pleasure. We appreciate your time. I want you to have a great weekend.
Thank you.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves, industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank. And founding director, their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their RIA project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond. Your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Hey, Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. Back in late 2007, early 2008, just before the financial crash, I was the keynote speaker for a major automotive organization in the U.S. In preparing for that presentation, I recall speaking with one of the group's board members about the state of the economy and how it was impacting the auto industry at that moment in time. He was alarmed about all the subprime auto loans being written by certain banking institutions at that time. Not only did he foresee significant negative fallout for the car industry, he also saw it for the banks writing the subprime loans. But he also explained that his viewpoint was the minority opinion of those in his organization and on his board of directors. He was a lone voice of dissent. As alarmist as my discussion with him was, it was nothing compared to what actually happened later in 2008 when the auto industry and the rest of the economy collapsed. That collapse is still in process. It never really ended. Aftershocks and new quakes have been making their way around the globe ever since. And once again, it appears we are on the eve of another major calamity in the subprime auto market, a likely precursor of something much larger to come. An article this week on Zero Hedge discussed a gentleman who said he is considering filing bankruptcy. It's presented as a harbinger of things to come for subprime auto lending. It's about a father who bought a car for his son as a graduation gift for just over $11,000 with a down payment of $1,750. The kicker was the 29% interest rate for 4 years. The son had stopped making insurance payments, which should be the moral of this story, and then wrecked the car. The finance company ultimately sued the father, who had co-signed for over $15,000, which included principal, accrued interest at 29%, plus legal fees. They started garnishing the father's wages and have thus far taken just over $22,000. The father assumed the debt was almost paid, but thanks to the magic of compound interest at 29%, he still owes nearly $13,000. Lots of people are in this predicament. In the St. Louis area alone where this situation occurred, since 2010, three auto finance companies have filed more than 15,300 lawsuits against borrowers in local courts. The vast majority of those cases resulted in a judgment against the defendant, after which the lender often sought to garnish wages from the borrower. Multiply this kind of activity across the country and you can see there is an epidemic of financial undercurrents that have never been fully acknowledged or explored since the 2008 financial crisis. Many who suffered in silent despair in 2008 and 2009 have been caught in what amounts to a massive undercurrent of financial waterboarding that never seems to end. this is just one more example. There will be some listeners to this who will scoff and say how stupid it is for anyone to take out a car loan at 29% interest. Yes, it's really a bad idea. But the fact is, some people have no other option. No other access. If you don't know any of those people, I would beg to differ. Because you most likely do. You may just not recognize the situation or them. But one thing I am very certain of is that during the next economic collapse, there will be even more people that fall into this kind of a category. And no matter how well you or your family think you have prepared, you may very well end up being one of those individuals yourself. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week.